This documentary discusses the topics of addiction, mental health and trauma, and it opens with a discussion on suicide, which some listeners may find upsetting. I was 20 when I went to take my own life. I had been having thoughts of suicide for probably at least a year, year and a half before this particular day, and I suppose the suicidal ideation, the thoughts of suicide, were just growing and growing all the time. And I developed a plan, and I spent months and months when I should have been attending lectures in college as an undergraduate planning my suicide, planning how I was going to kill myself. And I looked for places that I would do it, and I thought all the time about how I would do it. And on this particular day, I was walking down a laneway in Enniskerry, where I had been lots of times before to make this plan. And the plan was that I was going to slit my wrists, and I had found the razor blades I was going to use, and I had been carrying them in my college bag for months and months, and I was going to slit my wrists and also hang myself, because I really wanted to make sure that I did this right. On this particular day, I was walking down the same lane as I had done lots of times before, and something that never happened before, ever, when I came down this lane, was this huge dog leapt over a hedge out of a front garden of the only house that was on the road. And it gave me such a fright. And I can still feel the jolt in my body of the fright that the dog gave me. And the dog was standing right in the middle of this laneway, barking its head off. And I was just frozen. But I could feel my heart pounding in my chest. And the thing that really struck me as I stood there looking at this dog was that was the first thing, that fright and the pounding in my chest was the first thing that I had felt in so long. I had been so numb and in such a low, dark place for so long that I had lost any feeling. And that jolt of fright, I don't know, it just got me back into my body. And I turned around and I got on a bus and I went to my aunt's house. And I rang her doorbell and she answered the door and she said to me, "What's wrong?" And I couldn't speak. So she brought me in and she handed me some paper and a pen. And she said, "Write it down." So I wrote down what had happened. And she let me stay with her for a while. Amazing grace, how sweet the scent that saved a wretch like love.
But now I'm fed. Was
That was a difficult opening to this documentary, but it was deliberately made difficult because when we're talking about people in addiction or with mental health issues, we're talking about people whose lives are at risk. And when we're talking about people who have both an addiction and a mental health issue, we are talking about people whose lives are even more at risk. That's the focus of this documentary. This year, 2016, the Mental Health Division in the HSC published its operational plan for 2016. For the first time, it plans on developing a dual diagnosis program to offer a service to people with the dual diagnosis of addiction and mental health. From that day in Enniskerry, I went on to train and ended up working in addiction services for the last 17 years. From my experience, I have constantly met people who cannot get services because they have an addiction and a mental health diagnosis. I come up against the barrier to them accessing services time and time again. This year, because of this plan that the HSC is hoping to develop a program for people with dual diagnosis, we have the opportunity to do something differently. But in this documentary, I hope to put forward that maybe we could go a step further, that maybe there's something else that we could offer people that really underlies both those issues. St. Patrick's University Hospital in Dublin is the only centre offering a residential treatment programme for dual diagnosis in the country. Dr. Marie Nocton is a psychiatrist working on that programme. She explains what comorbidity is when there's a substance misuse and mental health issue.
Dual diagnosis is when a person has both an addiction and a diagnosed mental health disorder. It can be a mood disorder such as depression or bipolar affective disorder, where depression is interspersed with periods of elation. It can be an anxiety disorder, and there are various types of anxiety disorders. It can be a psychotic illness that somebody could have, and that happens concurrently, comorbidly, with an addiction. It can be addiction to substances such as alcohol, opioid medication, benzodiazepine medication, or to gambling. It can also be categorised in dual diagnosis.
Carol Moore is an advocate for people with dual diagnosis. She set up Dual Diagnosis Ireland after a family member of hers couldn't get a service after he was diagnosed with a mental health issue and an addiction. Here she talks about some families that she worked with and what happened when they couldn't access services due to their dual diagnosis.
One family we dealt with where their mother was on sleeping tablets. She'd attempted to kill herself and she'd been admitted into a mental hospital, and they said, well, alcohol is really your problem. So they discharged her and they got her a referral into an addiction treatment centre, who initially said they would accept her. But then when they saw that A, she was taking sleeping tablets, and B, that she had a mental health issue in that she had tried to kill herself, they refused to accept her. So again, a lot of advocacy work to try and get her into a place. So eventually, after quite a number of months, and this was a very articulate family, we eventually managed to get them at a week's trial in this particular centre. And the morning of the trial, of the day she was due to go into the centre, that woman killed herself.
I was screaming into the canyon at the moment of my death. The echo I created, I lasted my last breath.
And this is repeated time after time after time. The Quilter Oberyn case, we have been working with them to try and support them. Again, a very articulate, very engaged family. very, very clear that Caolte was only drinking because he had mental health issues. It was self-medication, right? But he could not get a service. And eventually, as we know, Caolte died.
My voice, it made an avalanche and buried a man I never knew.
And because your brains went public, you know, in a very clear way, and they're a very particular family, more and more people came forward. Addiction historically was seen as a moral failing. It was people who had bad characters. Mental health was always stigmatized.
I have only one thing to do, and that's be the wave that I am and then sink back into the ocean. I have only one thing to do, and that's be the wave that I am and then sink back into the ocean. Back into the ocean.
The best way of actually diagnosing it is a watch and wait in those early weeks. There are times when it's very difficult to make the diagnosis, and we have that expertise here to just watch mood symptoms. The nursing staff can see how they're sleeping, how they're eating, how they're interacting with people. And as the substances, as they remain abstinent from the substance, does their mood lift? And, you know, it could be the mood effects. Mm-hmm. Or the anxiety-inducing effects of the substances. And that's time telling us, is there an ongoing concurrent mood disorder? Okay. Is very, very valuable. And at times we do reformulate.
Louise describes her experience of psychosis as a result of her drug use.
Then I was in a relationship with a drug dealer, you know, and having the odd spliff here and there of crack, and that kind of built up, and he'd offer coke and crack, and I'd always pick the crack, and so that went on for a while. Then one day I ended up getting psychosis from it, and it was in his voice. So I'd be sitting there, I'd look at him and he'd say, you know, don't look at me, and I think, oh no, like, you can hear what I'm thinking. That really scared me, so I suddenly realised the dangers that drugs were causing me, because before I didn't really have no consequences.
The lights are on, but you're not home. Your mind is not your own.
My mum came to my flat and I was in a ball hearing voices, and she was so shocked and upset and worried even more than she'd ever been. And it was really scary.
Your heart sweats, your body shakes, another kiss is all it takes.
You know, Christmas time, I was creeping in my house after a meeting and not wanting to put the lights on, just in case he was there and he could see that I was in my house. And you know, I'm still dealing with the psychosis now. I was scared of my own shadow. I didn't want to go out. You know, I'm not staying at my flat at the moment. I'm staying at my mum's because I'm just suffering with it. You know, the psycho is quite scary, and it's when I'm on my own that it comes.
Jodie explains how even when she went into residential treatment for her addiction, her mental health issues remained.
Before I ever drank, when I was a kid, I do remember always feeling sad. Eventually, loads of trouble with drink, drugs, etc. When I was 20, my parents had split up at that stage, and my mother asked me and my partner at the time, who I lived with, if I would go to this rehabilitation centre.
Again, I'll kiss you. Tomorrow. Remember, I'll always be true.
So again, there was no talking about mental health issues at that time. When I went here, they ask you a load of questions when you go in to find out what addictions you have. So they ask you about drugs. They don't just ask you about drink. They ask you about drugs. They ask you about sex. They ask you about gambling. They ask you about food. And it transpired then that I have a food addiction also.
And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day, and I'll say all my loving to you.
I came out of there and I went into, there was psychologists that I saw, there was counsellors that I saw. The psychologist put me on Prozac. So initially I was on Prozac, I was on 20 milligrams a day. And I continued taking it for about 2.5 years. I didn't really see any helpful effects from it. And I know maybe it does help a lot of people. I'm just speaking from my own personal experience. made me feel no different. And every time I would go to the doctor and say, I really still don't feel good, they would say, right, well, you know, it's the dosage. It's, you know, obviously it's not enough to help you. You need to start taking another 20 milligrams every day. So by the end of about 18 months, I was on 100 milligrams a day, which is 5 tablets. And I was only 21 at this point. It's very young. I think now I look back and I say, what doctor would put a young girl on that much? But anyway, and I've, you know, I won't get into conspiracy theories, but I do think, you know, they get paid to give you this stuff.
Well, I'm a million and I just ain't got the time. What's more, I'm wasted and I can't find my way home.
You know, antidepressants should be, not be the first port of call, but for many GPs, they want to help. GPs are good people, you know, and I don't want to appear as if I'm demonising or labelling them. You know, I have a brilliant GP and I think they are very kind, caring patient, but they're so under pressure. The easiest thing is to write a script. And the model of payment for a GP encourages this because it only allows them 10 minutes, 6 minutes per patient. And it's very difficult to empathise because they're afraid if they open it up, they could be there for an hour. And we've gone too far into the clinical skills piece, the fixing piece, and I'll give you a medication for your bereavement feeling, right? And not enough into, yes, why wouldn't you be upset? And again, it's a problem with the way the healthcare system is structured, that the doctor is the linchpin.
Dr. Robert Simpson is the medical director of Cirque Lodge, a residential treatment centre in Utah. He specialises in acute detoxification and in the treatment of addicted healthcare professionals. He describes how the current opioid epidemic began in the United States.
Our current opiate epidemic really began in the 90s, at which there was a shift. There was real pressure for the medical system to be more sensitive about pain. There was actually a movement at that time about pain is the fifth vital sign, that you take somebody's, you know, pulse, blood pressure, temperature, and their pain.
Imagine living a life free of chronic pain. Today, science has formulated the power of cobra venom into a product called Cobroxin that can literally turn pain off.
And the docs had a huge amount of criticism at that time that they were not being sensitive enough about pain.
When there's inflammation in the body, your nervous system sends that data to the brain, and that's how you feel pain. Cobroxin effectively blocks the pain signal without harming your body. The pain simply disappears.
When that movement happened, pharmaceutical companies began retooling opiate analgesics to be much more potent, and this brought about the oxycodone, OxyContin, you know, a variety of others. And there was great kind of liberalizing of prescribing practices. And some of that was because there was sort of an expectation then that patients thought that no pain was a reasonable and achievable goal. And then there was backlash as we got into, you know, sort of 2005, 6, 7, when people started to overdose from these medications. So people are now physically dependent, people are addicted, and the death rate started to increase. And docs were criticized for prescribing in an overly liberal way. And so they responded to that by, you know, and inappropriately, by you know, often being too stringent, and people who were dependent were just cut off, which obviously isn't the right way to deal. Most of the people currently addicted to heroin in our country got there through prescription opiates.
I caught you knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby, can I have some more?
Dr. Andrea Barthwell is the Chief Medical Officer of the Manor Treatment Centre. She is also manager of the Two Dreams Outer Banks Treatment Centre. She has served as Deputy Director for the Office of National Drug Control Policy in the United States. And she is President of the Encounter Medical Group. She is also a founding member of the Chicago Area AIDS Task Force and a past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine.
We are being transformed by heroin and a very rapid expansion of heroin in the United States. And some of it is, you know, coming about because people have been exposed to pain medications and they get involved with pain meds and they can no longer afford them and heroin's more affordable. Some of it's happening because with marijuana legalization or decriminalization in many states in the U.S., the people who have been the providers of that can't use that for a cash crop anymore. Mm-hmm. So they're switching to heroin, and the gangs and the cartels that were involved with marijuana are pushing cheaper heroin because people don't have to buy marijuana from them anymore. But what we're having occur now with higher potency, more frequent use of the heroin is more death. And people who go to an emergency room with an overdose are, it's highly predicted that they'll have another overdose that will be fatal within a week of that occurrence. And so we're trying to figure out what to do as a country to stop the death. And we're in the midst of a public health crisis, so we have more exposure to treatment because of the Affordable Care Act, but more need for very effective programs for people who've been using opioids. I never meant to call you when you're far off. I never meant to call you when you're pain. A lot of people say that we don't have the same over-prescribing problem here that they do in the States. My experience is, at every meeting I go to with other services who work with people in addiction, is they spend so much time talking about their clients who are being over-prescribed medication by doctors. It is happening here. And they say that we are 10 to 20 years behind the United States in their treatment models of treatment for addiction and mental health, and we need to learn from their mistakes. And we need to not put the responsibility for diagnosing comorbidity, dual diagnosis and mental health difficulties on the GP. An integrated model of treatment is seen as best practice when trying to treat dual diagnosis, mental health and substance misuse difficulties. Dr. Marie Nocton explains why.
It is the evidence base in terms of treating both concurrently. It is, we know from experience that trying to treat a mood disorder or mental health illness while somebody is still actively using is a pointless exercise because of the mood effects that substances have. And we also know if somebody is very unwell with mental health issues, whether they've been very depressed, with no motivation, not looking into the future, or overwhelmed with anxiety, they're unable to participate fully in the groups and in the individual sessions to actually work through their addictions.
If the program like the one in St. Pat's is considered best practice, I asked the Minister for Mental Health, Helen McEntee, if a programme like that was going to be considered under the new Mental Health Division operational plan, which is being prepared this year. Do you think it's likely that this new operational plan would include a public residential programme for people with comorbidity?
Well, I suppose the dual diagnosis clinical programme that's been devised at the moment and will be rolled out at the end or by the end of the year, the three main focuses of that plan is to, I suppose, to ensure that the services that people are getting, that they're enhanced, to make sure that the accessibility to the services is increased, but also that there's a cost effectiveness there as well, which is important. And whether or not that means incorporating services on the one ground or within the one building, it might not be possible everywhere.
'Twas grace that taught my heart to feel, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear thee.
John McCann is CEO of ARC Interventions. He is a specialist consultant in intervention, a sober guardian, and he has developed family support and recovery assistance programs. He is also a trauma intervention specialist. John believes that understanding trauma in addiction can't be underestimated, and that knowing about an addict's life is sometimes more important than the substances they use.
I had one girl recently, a Belgian girl who was 30 years old, who for the last 10 years had convinced her family that she fell out of a bedroom window that was 60 feet up. During the course of the intervention, she was taking a lot of drugs, but when we first got into contact with her, she was on 42 different tablets a day. The system that she was being supported by wanted to medicate her so that she didn't fall out of a bedroom window again. She'd had no treatment. But during the course of the intervention, I asked her about it, and she said, "I didn't fall. I just couldn't cope. And the sad thing was I survived." That's tough. It's tough to hear. The good news is we can help that. She's doing fantastic. She's just a wonderful, wonderful young lady who's just, her life's just opened up. You know, she suffered a lot when she was younger. She had no one to talk to about it. And it's a huge problem in Europe, actually. There's not so much support in Europe. You know, the Americans haven't got it easy by any stretch of the imagination, but they've got a fantastic insurance system that drives the industry. Mm. Over here, there is a state system that supports a problem. It's a big difference. The problem is the answers cost money. And sometimes it's more than the state can either afford or want to afford, or want to do something about it. It's much easier to say it's a mental health issue. You need to go and see a psychiatrist because that's the cheap option. They'll medicate you, and if we medicate you, you're not going to cause any more trouble. Just stay on your meds, you'll be fine. How many times have you picked up a paper and read they let somebody out of a psychiatric unit and they've gone on a bit of a rampage and somebody's got hurt? Oh, but it's okay, he was off his meds. Well, you can medicate people or you can treat people. Sometimes you can't do both.
Kathleen O'Hara is an international expert on violent death trauma, bereavement caused by murder, suicide, drug overdose, drink driving, or any other sudden death. She's the author of A Grief Like No Other, Surviving the Violent Death of Someone You Love. Kathleen is a consultant for the US Department of Justice, Victim Support Europe, and Victims of Crime International. She has been a guest speaker at the United Nations on the mental health of women and girls, and she is a trusted family advisor to family offices globally. Kathleen's son, Aaron, was murdered by a crack cocaine addict during a burglary in his home one night.
Your own experience is that you lost a loved one by the hand of somebody who had a drug problem. It's rare to meet somebody who has worked and experienced both sides of that type of trauma.
Right, I see what you mean. So with regard to my son Aaron dying at the hands of the crack addict. Well, you know, it would have been the murder itself. Although I will tell you this, Susan. Having worked with addictions for so many years, and you step back, and we know the damage that addiction causes to family, to our society, to ourselves. And then you look at the homicide, and you see that was caused by someone who probably would not have done that if they'd been in their normal mind. So then we begin to see the scope of this addiction problem. That probably, and I think there's been research done on this, that in America anyway, if you look at the causes of death listed on the death certificate, how many, when they investigated, they found how many of them were related to drug and alcohol. It's so much higher than anybody really realizes. In fact, there are many, many deaths, as particularly violent ones, if you track them back, somewhere some drug and alcohol has been involved, either by the perpetrator and most times by the perpetrator. Because they're not in their right mind. And it could also, of course, be the person who has taken the drug.
And the other part of that you talk about is the forgiveness. I was just wondering about your own forgiveness and how you got to that place. And
well, it's still an ongoing process for me. It was interesting because my son went to a small Catholic university and was very dedicated to the faith, and we were a spiritual family. Right after the death, I was sent books from various people on forgiveness, which I opened it and threw it on the ground and thought, how dare you send me a book about forgiveness? I know where your intention is, but the thought of it, because I hadn't even begun to tackle the grief. How could I possibly? Now, I might understand that forgiveness is to be worked towards, and that is the ultimate form we would hope for. But that's by no means saying that I'm going to do it overnight. And I don't believe in superimposing something on top of something else simply because people think you should do it. And in our culture, we have this notion of who's a good victim and who's a bad victim. Oh, didn't forgive, still holding on to that anger? Bad victim. Particularly in America, this happens. So there's a thing. You get the homicide, you get the funeral, you get the, and then the forgiveness, boom, 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 we're all done. To me, that says you actually, in society, don't want to deal with us. So you'd like us to tidy it up, forgive the perpetrator, so we can all be hunky-dory after that. And that's not how it works. So I would say, in my own sense, what I have come to is that I don't have the anger for the two that did it. I have now a sense of compassion for the whole thing was a mess. These kids who did it were drug addicts. One of them had a horrible childhood. I'm not excusing it, but I have compassion for how everyone arrived at that murder scene that day, because we all took a path to get there. So I understand that. So now I'm developing that compassion, and I'm a person who actually believes the forgiveness comes out of this understanding naturally. It isn't something that I myself am capable of doing. It has to happen organically for me.
Think about it. There must be a higher love down in the heart, hidden in the stars above. Without it, life is wasted time. Look inside your heart, I'll look inside mine.
The evidence is and shows that you need a residential integrated model of care to be able to make a full diagnosis and assessment of comorbidity, substance misuse, and mental health. So the mental health division, their operational plan and their planned program for a dual diagnosis service, at the very minimum, what they need to be offering is nationwide residential dual diagnosis programs. That is the minimum. My argument in this documentary is that we need to go one step further than that. Why should we not be innovative in our approach to dual diagnosis? We have this opportunity now. We have this opportunity this year to put something in place, to really create something that is innovative and that, you know, and that is a treatment model which is trauma-informed, which recognizes the clear and clearly researched and clearly proven link between adverse childhood experiences and addiction and mental health issues in later teenage years and into adulthood. And we need trauma-centered and trauma-informed residential programs in order to really help people to address the issues that underlie addiction and mental health. And we need to offer those programs throughout the country. And we need this plan that the HSC has for addressing dual diagnosis to include residential trauma treatment programs. That's where we should be focusing. This documentary is due to be completed on the 4th of August. The 2nd of August is a very significant date for me. It's a recovery anniversary date. And for me, recovery really means the process that I have gone through in not wanting to get out of myself anymore. I'm not in pain anymore, and I don't want to run from myself anymore. And the mental health difficulties and addictions that I have struggled with through the years, that's all I wanted to do. All I wanted to do was get out of my own skin. I didn't realize, actually, until about a week before completing this documentary, that that anniversary coincided with the finishing of this documentary. And it's a nice thing to be able to say that I really love my life today.
Oh, it's times like these you learn to live again. It's times like these you give and give again. It's times like these you learn to love again. It's times like these, time again.
If you have been affected by anything in this documentary, I encourage you to get help. Reach out. There are lots of services in this country that can help you, and there are lots of people that want to help you. Just to give some numbers here and now, the Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123. That's 116 123. Suicide or Survive can be contacted on 1890 577 577. That's 1890 577 577. There are many other organisations, so please reach out if you need to.